but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Oregon's defense last season was terrific for most of the season, right up until the Big Ten championship game, and Penn State ran all over the Ducks. And then, of course, the Rose Bowl. You still want to talk about the Rose Bowl? We have to, don't we? Oregon has to be better. Tosh Lapoy, the defensive coordinator at Oregon, he's been a tough interview. People have told me you're not going to get much out of him. He's not going to say much. I'm making it my mission today on the show. We're going in depth and one-on-one with Tosh Lapoy, the Oregon defensive coordinator. He's joining us now, fresh off the practice field in Eugene. Tosh, thanks for doing this. Appreciate you, man.
No problem. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You're a Bay Area kid. I think you're a Walnut Creek kid. Is that right? Stone Ridge Mall. What was your mall growing up?
No, it was more, I have lived in Walnut Creek for sure. Yeah. I've kind of lived all over the East Bay and Concord, and my mom's from Oakland, so certainly the East Bay, but not so much Stone Ridge. It was more in the Concord area.
How about, East Bay kid, you had to be an A's fan and a Raiders fan, I'm thinking, and because I was a Giants Niners guy.
Yeah, I definitely went to both of those quite a bit, took the BART over there, but, you know, not a huge baseball fan, and, you know, this was more so either in the outdoors or playing sports rather than watching TV.
I told people I was interviewing you, and everybody said, you're not going to get anything out of him. He plays it close to the vest. So I'm more interested in kind of getting to know you a little bit, letting fans get to know you a little bit more, and then we could talk a little bit about the team. But growing up, what was that like? Who were your influences growing up? Sounds like mom was around there.
Yes, certainly from an early age, one of the strongest influences is my grandfather. He is a poor immigrant that came over and played a big role in just instilling work ethic, you know, really just attacking every day and striving for improvement. And, you know, he was always a big influence in my life. You know, just fortunate to be around some great coaches early on. I was a ball boy for Bob Lattiser. Mm-hmm. You know, I think around ages 7, 8, 9 years old. And my brother was a big influence on me as well. He's 5 years older than me. He played at De La Salle, so I was a ball boy during that time, and then that led into attending De La Salle. And so, you know, being around Coach Lattiser was very influential as well, you know, and then really leading into, you know, a series of coaches that I've just been really fortunate to be around, from Steve Sarkisian and Nick Saban, Kirby Smart, Dan Quinn, Urban Meyer, now Coach Lanning. You know, Coach Lanning was a graduate assistant of mine at Alabama, and we stayed in strong, you know, connection after that when he went to Georgia and I went off to the NFL. And certainly, you know, even to this day, just, you know, having an influence in the way he operates, and me being in line with that. So I think all those things play into, you know, who I am today. I'm a strong believer in, you know, who you are around is who you become. And that can go both in a negative direction or a positive direction. So it's very important to me of, you know, making decisions of who I'm around, is being around people I respect and people that I know I can grow from and improve from. You know, that's what I attempt to do, whether it's the jobs that I take and the people I associate with, you know, when we leave the buildings.
your grandfather, I want to drill down there, because my grandfather was an immigrant as well. And, you know, I know when they came over, they worked, you know, my grandfather worked blue collar jobs. He was in a steel mill and he was in a foundry. He was pouring molten steel, and all he wanted was opportunity, right, for his kids and grandkids. What did your grandpa do when he immigrated?
Yeah, it would be a very similar story. He originally was in Pennsylvania, where they call Little Italy. And my understanding, the history there was very similar to what you described, extremely blue collar, and then unfortunately quite a bit of, you know, crime and mob activities back in those days. And so he ended up going west, you know, almost starting over again, and he got into the produce market. So, you know, basically my entire family was raised in that produce market. My father worked there, my mother worked there, all my siblings, and you know, I was so young at the time, this was the early 80s, that I would go there every day, but you know, I wouldn't necessarily be working. I'd be probably playing on the roof or you know, jumping around in cardboard boxes. I would go to the Oakland Pier with my grandfather quite a bit. Those are some of my earliest memories, where he'd get up, you know, around 4 a.m. and he would drive out to the Oakland Pier and get fresh seafood, fresh fish, and then fresh produce, and then bring it back in to the East Bay inland, you know, 20-something miles. At his produce market, it was called Lupoy's Market. And then open at 6 a.m. And that was, you know, back then there was no Safeways or you know, giant marquee like produce markets. So that was a huge hit, you know, where people would just be able to access fresh fish, crab, produce early in the morning inland. So, you know, that was a cool memory back in the day there.
Do you, like, if you go into a Safeway now, do you find yourself, like, judging the produce and kind of looking at, all right, this is good, this is bad, because you know it?
Yeah, I don't, but my family members certainly do. My father does, and no, they certainly do.
When you're a ball boy at De La Salle, and for people who don't know De La Salle, I mean, De La Salle just for decades won games and had that terrific win streak, and you know, your brother certainly part of those teams. You were there watching it, kind of at a young formative age. Would it surprise you, like, if we went back and told that kid, hey, you end up in coaching, or did you kind of know at that point, hey, this is really cool, I want to be around this?
I did not. You know, I'm certainly not the story where I hear consistently from a lot of coaches that they knew they wanted to coach. I did not. I wanted to play. And so I was just hell-bent on playing in the NFL, going to the NFL. You know, I had a strong passion for the game, but I did not see myself, you know, coaching at that point. It was all about playing for me.
Tosh Lapoy with us, Oregon defensive coordinator. I was on the field after the Big Ten championship game. Confetti's falling. There's a lot of celebration. Certainly you guys had a great season, a lot to be proud of. But I saw you walk by. You didn't look totally happy after that game. And I think, you know, you're probably always thinking about the things you could do better. Where was your mind in kind of the wake of that Penn State game?
Well, I think through victory and defeat, you know, never accepting the imposter they both are. So I'm just always reminding myself, you know, remove the emotion of the result and look, you know, what happened from a very clinical view. So that's always my approach. So, you know, I would venture to say, you know, fortunately we won every single game until the last one. But even through those, you know, tough, we've only had, I think, 6 total losses since we've been here, going on to year 4. But in those losses, I don't know if you'd see much of a different, you know, reaction as far as right after the game. It's just immediately I'm thinking about the same thing of, you know, what could we have done better? You know, there was a critical moment in that game on a fourth and long situation. We were up by 15 points, I believe, in the fourth quarter. But, you know, a great opportunity right there where we could possibly, you know, shut the door for good and that game not even be within two scores at the end. So that was, you know, when you asked me that question, that's exactly where my mind was of the call that I made then. Was that the right call in that situation? So, you know, but it, on game day, regardless, you know, I don't think I'm going to, whether the ups and downs, you know, I'm going to try to keep consistency there, both for myself and for my players, and have the ability to reset and make sure that, I'm in a correct mindset to call the game the right way and not allow any emotions to affect that.
What did you learn? Those, you know, I think throughout the season, I was like, wow, this defense is not, you know, if you get 17 points on Oregon, you're doing well. End of the year, you run into some really talented teams, and maybe some of this is just football, but what do you learn in the Penn State and the Ohio State game that you can carry forward?
Yeah, it was awesome growth moments. You know, like you mentioned, I mean, we, out of the 13 opponents we played last season, we held 10 of them to three scores or less. You know, was able to get a shutout on the road and do some cool things. And we were sitting there after the regular season, going into postseason play, you know, right there as a top 10 dominant defense, again, back-to-back top 10 scoring defenses, and the goals that we put up, you know, during camp, and now we got to go climb that mountain and accomplish those. And then, you know, just gave up too many explosive plays in the postseason play, both the Big Ten Championship and the Rose Bowl, and gave up too many points, plain and simple. So immediately, you know, how can we attack those and utilize those really as an opportunity? So, you know, there were things from a schematic approach, you know, where we felt like having some calls that had too many checks, and especially when the opponent does a good job, like Chip Kelly and Ohio State did with, I think, recognizing after game one where we would get into specific checks that really helped us. Mm-hmm. They did a great job of, you know, getting us into those checks and then really game planning those checks. You know, and three touchdowns alone were within those checks. So great example is how do we grow? Well, we can still have a defense that's made up of those checks that's helped us win and attack and play really well, but also have come up with some new calls where you can just play out the integrity of the defense and not get in the check. So that would be one example from a schematic standpoint that we feel like we're really sharp and better from. We applied in the offseason, applied in spring ball, and applied in camp, where we feel like we now have the ability to do one or the other, and have installed it where the players aren't necessarily overloaded with volume. So feel good about that. Second thing is always going to attack the self-scout and say, all right, here's the things we've done great. Here's some things that we can look at, do better, and then, you know, take five of the best NFL defenses, five of the best college defenses, and match up those specific situations in football. For example, just overall rush yards per carry and preventing touchdowns in the red zone. Those would be two right there where, you know, looking at those categories both in the NFL and college. So, again, experimenting with possibly some schematics or just saying, hey, we got to get better at these certain fundamentals and techniques where we failed. We feel like we're in the right call, but we got to improve there. So those are some growth moments for us, you know, that we've attacked and feel confident right now, applied those even in yesterday's practice, and, you know, try to grow as a program to take that next step and be, you know, where we truly want to be and not, you know, not using recruiting that, you know, we're back-to-back top 10 defenses. You know, we want to you know, have the pride and say, like both Coach Lanning and myself have been in, you know, in the past, or say, you know, we're the best defense, not just a top 10 defense.
Tosh Lapoy with us, Oregon D coordinator. You played at Cal. Could Tosh Lapoy, the player, play for Tosh Lapoy, the coach?
I hope not. I want to have I want to have a I want to always recruit better. So you know, I actually tell our coaches this quite a bit, where I think coaches sometimes go out and they're trying to recruit themselves. And I absolutely do not want to do that. I want somebody that starts with, you know, it's bigger, stronger, and faster. Hopefully, you know, I can display some elements of toughness and relentless effort. But certainly, as a, in totality, I want a much better and talented player, more talented player.
Do you look for late bloomers? Because I often think that work ethic that you talk about, that maybe you got from grandpa, and you know, you had to be tough, you had to have it, but it's born from, I better be on it because there might be a more talented or bigger guy across the line. And so I always look at kind of, you know, the Michael Jordan thing, you know, people will cast him as a late bloomer, and I wonder how much of him being a late bloomer contributes to him being like the greatest player ever. Is that hold up in recruiting?
Yeah, I think it's the evaluation process is extremely important. So just as much pride that I take in, whether it's the schematics of defense or coaching the position in a defense, is also the evaluation, you know, so being extremely thorough in that. And that's where you can, you know, find some of those guys that's really hard these days to find, probably, is the diamonds in the rough, so to speak. But, you know, a great reminder is just looking at your roster and looking at a guy like Bryce Betcher, you know, and to see how he's developed, you know. So it's getting harder and harder, unfortunately, because of the portal and, you know, a number of other things where, you know, whether it's roster limits and things of that nature, to be able to, you know, bring those guys aboard where you see, you know, they got some great traits but need a lot of help or development. You know, or might, you know, they've only played football for a season or so, but it's harder, but it's certainly something that I think if you're very thorough in your evaluation phase, that those guys are still out there. And, you know, we're one of the few programs, my understanding too, you know, just sticking to the philosophy, obviously we still have a spring game, but things of that nature, we still have camps. So, you know, we go out and attend satellite camps, which you don't see a lot of marquee programs doing as much anymore. We take a lot of pride in that, of finding those type of guys that you're talking about. And then we hold three separate camps on campus too. And we have a walk-on tryout as well on campus. And so I attend every one of those, and you know, the evaluation continues. But Bryce Betcher, he was actually one who attended that walk-on tryout on campus, you know, and I don't know how many people are aware of that.
Yeah, you get guys like that. Those guys can be glue for your program. Before I cut you loose, you know, I talked to Coach Lanning about this, but this job has changed. While you've been in this business, it has become year-round. You've got multiple portal windows. The recruiting element of it has shifted. The development element has shifted. It looks exhausting from the outside in. How do you avoid burnout?
One, you embrace, you know, what you signed up for. So the fact is, there is no balance. So, you know, people that pretend there is, or maybe there is for some other people, and that's perfectly fine. But I think if you look at, you know, whether it's the most successful programs or coaches, you know, There is a correlation, a lot of, you know, guys and coaches that are obsessed, and that's exactly what I am. But it's more so finding that, accepting it, embracing it. And then the other things in life that are extremely important to you, such as for me with my wife, Jordan, and my family, is understanding that there is not going to be a balance here. So when you do get those special moments to be with them, whether that's your 2.5 week vacation in summer or your week off at spring break, you know, or, you know, you get a player's recovery day and you get two hours of bonus time in the evening, whatever that be, is that you pour into that moment and go all in that moment as well. You know, so that's the time where you do actually let go and take away from the job you know, put your phone away no matter what, and be where your feet are in that moment. So that's what I would say as far as, you know, just the investment of taking the opportunity advantage. And when I'm in here in the office, you know, it's kind of the exact, you know, same way, where it's like, I'm all in here, and, you know, you're not thinking about your life to-dos or the other things in life. And so once I think you get to that moment of understanding that and embracing it, at least for me, it makes it a lot better.
Now, my grandpa and his family, when they came from Italy, they settled in Pennsylvania as well, in a small steel town, Vandergrift, Pennsylvania. And they, like you said, they were also running a bowling alley during Prohibition, and there was gambling and alcohol running out of the back of the place. So I think, you know, our grandparents probably had a very similar experience and upbringing. Yeah. And he also came west. He came to California. So I think that was part of the immigrant dream.
The Lupoys and Canzanos might have some affiliation there.
There might have been. They might have been hopping on trains together heading west. So who knows? Hey, I appreciate making time for us, man.
Okay. All right. Have a good one.
I love that interview with Tosh Lapoy. Who knows? The Lapoy family, the Canzano family back in the day in Pennsylvania, immigrant families. Who knows? It was a rough upbringing. My grandfather, as he described it to me, often, I mean, they were fighting and scrapping, and the immigrant families were all fighting for hierarchy within the United States, and, you know, came through Ellis Island and were looking for opportunity. My grandfather, I've documented, you know, what the Rose Bowl meant to him. He was a Pitt fan, rooting for Pitt. They were playing USC in the 1930 Rose Bowl. He came west to go see the Rose Bowl game, traveled all across the country at the age of 20 with his friends, trying to get to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. Saw the Rose Bowl, you know, saw Pasadena, saw the rose blossoms on the cherry trees in January, and said, someday I'm going to live out here. And that's what do I exist if the Rose Bowl doesn't exist? I've often wondered that. Good stuff with Tosh Lapoy. I want you to leave it here. I got the Bald-Faced Truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.